Boy, we'll take pictures of some of these discs, maybe?
Sure,
we could put it up, because that's what you wanted to show me, right? This is a Superman disc?
I just brought them along for show and tell. That looks
amazingly clean.
Yeah, this is a lacquer disc.
Yeah.
An original. It was made at the time of the broadcast of a lost Superman episode. Nobody has heard this in 60 years.
But you have it, so it's not lost.
Not
thank goodness.
I found about 14 of these from 1943 and 44.
Now, do the people you found them from know that you have them? Or?
Well, I paid for them.
Oh, you did? Okay. I want to make sure that this is legal, that we're not looking at some kind of contraband here. Yeah.
But yeah, so this is a lacquer disc.
And it says July 7, 44. Now, is that the date of broadcast?
That is the date of broadcast.
Okay, it's not the date of recording.
It's a live program.
Okay.
And this was, as best I can tell, it's just a regular kind of standard yellow and black audio disc recording blank label. So as best I can tell, this was recorded by a local station off the Mutual line to delay the broadcast by either later in the day, probably just later in the day. I can't imagine they would be shifting the whole serial down multiple days. And they were obviously doing this for years because this was in a set of 14 others scattered throughout 1943 and 44. So somewhere there are the other ones.
Okay.
We haven't found them.
Yes.
Yeah. This
and what's on the other side?
The other side was Banded Music, as I noted here. Totally unrelated.
Any clue who it is?
I don't remember. It was very uninteresting, or I would have noted more if it was worth talking about. It may have just been music with no singing and no announcing and not really of much value to us to help tell the Superman story. But all of the 14 discs that are like this had Superman only on one side, which is odd. Mm-hmm. If they were just using it to play the next day, they wasted the whole side.
Right.
And so sometimes the other side will be blank or just have a little bit of another program or even a commercial. Or just blank, as I said. This number here is some kind of internal serial number for whatever station was doing this.
So that's a station assigned.
They all have numbers like this.
Okay.
And as I say, this date does match up with the published Superman logs that are out there.
Right.
I have contacted DC Comics to try to get them to help me just confirm the dates and see. And there is one disc that I don't have a date. Because it was just written in China marker and rubbed off. I haven't been successful so far in finding out.
Does anyone there remember that Superman was on a radio program?
They do because they still license it. You know, Radio Spirit sells sets of things that are licensed from DC Comics. And the person I talked with knew that they had scripts. It was just a matter of trying to find what they had done with them in the arc. Because they're all part of Warner Brothers and Time Warner.
Which means that they could be lost in the bureaucracy at some point.
Yeah,
so they have to find someone who actually cares about these things.
So this is
good when you do that.
This is an instantaneous recording. I mentioned earlier it was made at the time of broadcast, and that's true. This physical, literal disc would have been sitting on the disc cutter at whatever station this was at the time the show was being done. And the second hole is called a drive hole.
Right.
And that's where the disc cutter engages a second pin.
Right. And that's
the disc.
And that's
stable.
To make sure that it
doesn't slip.
It doesn't slip and you don't get wow and flutter and all other kinds of things. Right.
So excellent sound quality on all of these,
Well, it looks in very, very nice shape.
Of course I cleaned it before.
So it's always nice when people forget they have things and they put them accidentally in a perfect spot.
Yeah.
All right. Okay, so we'll put the sleeve on here.
Superman.
I hope I'm qualified for that. I'm not used to handling rare items like that, sir. And this is a Lone Ranger disc, but this is
a different kind of
one
disc
than you typically find.
Right.
I've seen a lot of the ABC Lone Ranger ones, but this is an RCA.
This is a syndication disc. This is where most of the Lone Ranger episodes that we have come from.
Yeah.
The version that was done for syndication.
Right.
Not checks off the network with commercials, which is what a lot of shit.
Now, that says program number 1914. I know Lone Ranger has a circulates often with two numbers, one starting with an NBC syndication number and
the actual program number? The number that would be higher if they put it on here would be the episode number starting from the beginning.
So from the original WXYZ when it was just a Detroit program.
So when they start, the whole reason why these Lone Ranger recordings exist is for one purpose. It's not because, wouldn't it be nice to make a recording of our show so we can hear it? Although some recordings do exist.
Of course.
Like that. But the vast majority of the Lone Ranger shows are on discs like this with different label variations, but pressings. The whole purpose is because they wanted to syndicate the show to stations that weren't on the network. It's called extension spotting.
Sure.
So that's why these were made. And stations would contract with...
So we learned a new phrase today.
extension spotting.
Right. Okay.
And usually that's applied to when the sponsor is spotting the show on a particular station. In this case, there's no sponsor on these discs. The Lone Ranger
Incorporated... So there's no General Mills or anything
The Lone Ranger Incorporated is the company that owns the program.
Right.
They would contract with a station in whatever market. And either Lone Ranger Incorporated would broker with a sponsor, or depending on the arrangement they made, or the station could purchase the program and then arrange for their own sponsor on their station. Either way, this is a recording made from the live version from WXYZ, recorded in Chicago by RCA, just like a regular record would be, pressed into vinyl discs.
Right.
So this, unlike the Superman disc, which we had out a minute ago, is not an original in the sense that this physical disc was not on the turntable.
Right.
The day,
in the studio.
This is a pressing from metal parts that would have been done days or probably days after the program was actually performed.
Now, part two of the program is on the back.
That's right.
So what happened? Were the engineers particularly adept at flipping the disc and getting the needle down?
When they made the recording, of course, they would have had two turntables so that you wouldn't miss anything.
Right.
And probably the way the Lone Ranger works, there's a long musical interlude at the middle portion of the program that if you were listening to the network show would be covered over with a commercial.
Right.
And once this disc is played back on a local station 2 weeks later or so, they would be reading a live commercial over that music. So an announcer's reading the commercial.
So
the engineer's playing the disc.
They would send the volume of the music down.
You would pot it down. When it got to the end, they would have to flip this disc over.
You can tell you're in the business because you say pot it down. Okay.
Flip the disc over.
Yeah.
Start it again.
Right.
And
so you get that all queued up so he can go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now there are... They probably switched to having part one and part two at some point in the 40s because it got annoying to have lots of part ones and part ones and part twos and part twos. But there are discs from the late 30s that are like that, where you'll have part one of one program flip it over part one of another program. And that's annoying because they invariably only turn up in one.
Now, if I'm remembering correctly, some of the early Ziv discs that I had were like that. In a lot of ways, that made a lot more sense.
Well, and in the case where you don't have a long musical interlude to flip the disc over, you have to have it on two separate discs so that you can have continuous play.
Sure.
But because of the nature of the way they did these programs, with the music in the middle, they could get away with it.
Yeah. Yes. So the only people who complained about it were people who weren't able to sell the middle commercial.
Right.
So it would just have some local announcement, I guess.
Now, I'll show you a trick.
About bingo at some church or something. Yeah.
You may or may not know this.
Yeah.
Transcription discs that are pressed almost invariably will carry a matrix number.
That's right.
And it'll be different based on what company made it.
Now, I'm going to tell you something embarrassing because I did not know any of these things when I was recording from discs around 1976, 1977, which I guess predates you, right?
By a little bit.
Okay, yes. So, and we didn't have digital cameras at that time. So as I've noticed more and more collectors of transcriptions today, they have the great benefit of digital cameras where they're taking pictures of the labels. But they're also making a big effort to record all these matrix numbers, which are etched, or in some cases, looks like this one may have been pressed or cut into it.
Right.
And there's secrets in there for
everybody.
There
are, yes.
So what are the secrets that this one has?
Well, this again is the Lone Ranger disc, and it's got the matrix number in two places. It's stamped into the metal part, so it gets reproduced in the dead wax, in the, in the, call it dead wax in quotation marks.
Right, dead wax because there's no grooves in there of any recording.
Yeah, and there's no wax at all. This is vinyl.
Right, right.
But it's there. It is stamped in the dead wax area after the runout. It's also printed on the label.
So we learned more new words today: the runout and dead wax.
Yeah.
And this is quite amazing.
Now, at some about 19, and the real record experts like Mike Beal would get me on this. I'm just going to estimate about 19.
Yeah, but he gets everybody.
I know.
Yeah, that's the way he
about
is.
About 46 or 47.
Yeah.
RCA changed over the Matrix series for transcriptions. Before this, you'd have a number like MS0987, blah,
right,
blah, blah. And that would stand for movie size, 16-inch. That's what the M was for. S, semi-high quality.
Right.
Refers to the quality of the cutting and electronics.
Okay.
And then a long serial number, which if you had the book, you could just follow.
Oh, yeah. That's the Lone Ranger serial episode number such and such.
Now, they changed over to a different system about 46.
Now, I'm looking at the cut here.
Mm-hmm.
So this number that's etched in the dead wax area, my new phrase today, matches exactly.
It does match this number.
Right? Except this one says 1
dash
at
one.
The end of it because...
That means take 1.
Take 1. Okay.
So occasionally you will run into a Ranger disc or another program that might have a dash 2.
Okay.
That's kind of a... It's not a mystery. We know what it means. It means take 2. What we don't know is if it means... necessarily if they were running a secondary turntable on the original performance, or what I suspect occasionally happened, if there was a problem when they were making the recording,
right,
the line went down, or occasionally these discs would have defects and get destroyed as they're making, or there could be a problem in the processing and pressing part of this whole process where the disc is subjected to heat and all.
Sure.
Something could have happened.
Sure.
I suspect maybe on occasion they ruined part 1 or part 2 and had to call down to Detroit, hey,
say,
your,
please send us
your transcription is destroyed, you're going to have to remount the episode.
Right.
That's just a...
And so they would have a second transcription table that could then record from their master
in the
studio?
I don't believe... Well, I don't know. Again, this is just supposition.
Yeah.
They may have performed... It may have been easier to perform it live again. Or if WXYZ had a reference copy that they made on site, sure, they could have played it up the line. But in any case, sometimes you will see a dash 2, and that does... That means second something.
Yeah.
We call it take 2 in record collecting. It could be a literal take 2 of the performance, or, as you suggest, maybe they would send a recording... up the line.
So now the
number before it, 66087, that's the serial number.
Right.
And that corresponds to this very recording. No other disc will have this serial number with these prefixes. That's how they kept track of the disc in the RCA Victor files. And it's what the metal master would have had.
Right.
That's why it's on here. Because when this disc is not a press disc, there's no label on it. So they had to have some way to keep up with what this was.
Yeah.
In the warehouse, it's full of thousands and thousands of transcription numbers.
Yeah.
CEO.
Or that's really... Is that CE0?
CE0.
Okay.
That is part of the dating system.
Mm-hmm.
And you can date these discs roughly, once they started this system, by this prefix. The E is for... is the fifth letter of the alphabet.
Right.
That means 5.
Right.
So we're talking 1950-something.
Right.
The 0 means 0, 1950.
Okay.
You'll see D7 and D8 and D9. That's 1947, 48, and 49. So that's a rough way to figure out.
That's interesting to know.
If you don't have any other way.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, if we didn't have a Lone Ranger log, this doesn't tell us when this thing was broadcast, so you would have to figure out roughly 1950 just from that number there.
And you can't go to a newspaper because no newspaper said we're broadcasting program number 1914 today.
Yeah.
So you have to go back to the logs, and the best logs originate with the original broadcast logs in production or at that
or with
particular
the scripts,
station.
If you have, if
the
you
scripts,
have access
of course,
to
too. Yeah.
The scripts and production paperwork. Yeah, newspaper logs will always be. Sometimes it's all you have, but you know that they're always kind of a best case.
And if it's a show that has a title, sometimes some newspapers picked it up, others didn't. But the Lone Ranger really didn't have titles, So you'd see a lot of people with trying to pick up the main outlaw or the person in peril or whatever.
Well, that changed over time. The early ones apparently did not have titles, but then at some point they did start titling the scripts. I don't know that that was necessarily ever released to the public, and I don't think they ever say the title.
Yeah,
on the episode.
So on the script you may see something totally different.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty cool. Now, I have a question. We take a picture of the label, and that's great. It's hard to take pictures of what's in the matrix.
Mm-hmm.
So, have you tried anything to do that?
Have you tried
putting some chalk dust or something in there?
No, normally you just have to, if you have the access to the disc in your hand, you can usually rotate it around.
Rotate it so that
enough so that the light
the glare disappears.
And so you'll have to take two pictures.
Yeah.
One of just head on of the label and another. I've seen, you know, you can scan these things, and probably by using high contrast scanning,
you could make that
number pop out more than.
But it just underscores that it's really important, since we know so much more today. And if I had the patience to record discs, I would obviously know a lot more today. Write that number down, and when you take the picture of the label, include that number in the file name.
Not only does the matrix number unlock all kinds of secrets, potentially, for the particular program you're working on, if, in this case, we know roughly when this date would be, so we don't have to go looking up the matrix number.
Right.
But if we had a complete listing of all the Lone Ranger matrix numbers, roughly what the dates are, then we go to other programs that are recorded by RCA Victor that we may not have dates for.
Right.
If the numbers are close,
you can start triangulating around them.
Right. It gives you a clue as to when the program is from.
Well, that's pretty neat. Well, let's play this right here. I've got a key, and you can spin it on your. No, we obviously cannot do that. Where do you store these, or how do you store them? I've heard so many things about the best way to do that. I'm always told on edge.
Yeah.
Sometimes I worry about that, but does it depend on the kind of disc it is?
Well, it does. I mean, a vinyl disc is not really going to crack easily. You could, if you applied enough pressure, make this crack or chip. But you don't have to handle it quite so delicately as you do a shellac transcription.
Right.
We were talking about those witch's tail transcriptions.
Right. The ones that I had in 1976.
They are very heavy and made out of shellac, just like standard 78 RPM records of the era were.
Right. And they were very thick.
They can break.
Yeah.
Right. Especially if you stack them and there's a lot of pressure from the top. It's best to store them on edge. You're not going to get in any trouble if you have several inches of vinyl disc.
But if you've got a 3 or 4 foot pile, you're going to cause a lot of problems.
The one on the bottom is going to be getting a lot of stress, especially if it's not stored on a flat surface. If you've got it, anything with any ridges or anything where different pressure points are being applied.
You can never assume that a floor is flat.
Right. Sure. So it is best to store them on edge. Mm-hmm. I had custom heavy-duty wooden shelves built in my new house for the transcription. So that's where I've...
You mean the house that I'm breaking into tonight to get access to all the transcriptions?
I had these stored in big heavy-duty plastic bins, which was kind of hard to find things. And when I got my house, I wanted to be able to get to the discs easily, so I had custom wooden shelves built.
Now, You are a prominent person at a major cable operation in terms of production. I just said prominent because it sounded good. Were you always interested in broadcast recording?
Always.
And so from the first time you saw television, first time you heard radio, you were curious about
that. From the first time, I had a tape recorder in my hands from when I was in elementary school, and probably like a lot of people, made my own radio shows as a kid, and was interested.
You don't dare listen to them now, right?
It's hard to listen to. Even if I occasionally do, it would be in private. I don't think the world is ready to hear it.
Everyone has those kinds of secrets, stuff you don't want to hear.
But that made me very interested in broadcasting and how recording worked.
So when did you get a interest in the history of it?
Well, I discovered my first OTR show when I was in the fifth grade. The local library, as some still do, had some programs on tape. And the first shows I ever heard were The New Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce. And it was a set that was put out by Sandy Hook, Dave Golden's company, of 8 episodes called, and I remember the set was titled Tales from Baker Street. And it had Scandal in Bohemia, Speckled Band, The Great Gandolfo, Murder by Moonlight, Bruce Partington Plans, which was not from the New Adventures, that's from the original NBC series, and a few others, 8 shows, and I listened to them to death. Those the first things I heard. From that point, I mean, that's the first old radio I had discovered, even though I had been interested in recording and making my own.
But you had no sense of that history. You were more a techie guy.
Yeah.
And until
I found those tapes. And from that point on, I just found you could discover things everywhere. There were more tapes in the library. You could, at that point, you could find cassettes of shows in all kinds of crazy places, like Walmart stores and Cracker Barrels. And so just as a kid, you would find, here's 2 more episodes of The Shadow, and here's 2 episodes of Jack Benny, 2 episodes of Burns and Allen. And I got exposed to all the big shows that way. And then at some point, I must have realized there's got to be a better way to do this. There's got to be a better way to collect shows than just finding random things. And so I found the Radio Spirits catalogs and the Adventures in Cassettes catalogs, and like a lot of people, started collecting on cassette tape that way. And I always hated cassette.
There was good reason, nostalgia
for cassette. It was, it was a quick and easy way to listen to shows.
It was convenient.
But, I was 10 years old in 1993, and that's probably the first time I ever heard a CD. And even to a 10-year-old, I could tell
quite the difference.
Quality was better. I mean, there was no hiss. The highs and lows didn't come and go as wavy tape passed over the heads.
Yes.
So at that point, I realized there were better ways to record sound. And then, of course, the first consumer CD recorders started coming out about, 1995 or 96?
Yeah, and they were only about $400 or $500.
To a kid, that sounded like a lot.
It was.
Now it's...
it was.
They still cost about $400 or $500.
Well, some of the good ones.
So once, I realized that record radio programs that way, and I started to, when I could, collect them on CD, and Dave Golden, for a while, before he sold his company, put shows out on CDR, and then when I got my own recorder, and could start doing my own dubs.
So when did you learn about transcriptions?
Probably the first, it must have been through little things in catalogs, like Dave Golden's catalog. Maybe the word transcription disc might have been used in a Radio Spirits catalog when they were asking for if people had missing episodes.
Yeah.
Probably the first time I came across the word.
Yeah.
And the internet is around by this point, so once I discovered how these shows were being recorded, and you could tell they were not made on tape. Mm-hmm. Just anybody who's interested in sound, the little things that happen on records that don't sound like tape.
Right.
And even though I had never held a transcription disc before, probably pretty early on I realized that this had been dubbed from some kind of disc medium.
Right. The original broadcast did not have scratches in it, right?
But the disc does.
But the disc does, yes.
I'm sure I started reading online. Dave Golden put out a book that became the basis of his Radio Golden decks that I bought for just very little money, probably through either Radio Spirits or Adventures in Cassettes. And he talked a lot about transcription discs in there, had some pictures. I remember they also used to have pictures in the Radio Yesteryear catalogs of disc labels.
Yeah.
And I started scouring eBay for interesting things. The first transcription disc I ever bought,
I was about to ask,
was a banded music, AFRS music library disc of, I believe it was Tex Beneke playing Glenn Miller hits in the Glenn Miller style, something like that. Mm-hmm. I couldn't play it, but it was interesting because it was a great big 16-inch disc.
That was the other question.
Yeah.
How did you play it?
I couldn't.
So you just, it was there You wanted it because of the historical nature of it.
Right. From that point on, I started collecting little pieces here and there, even though I couldn't play them yet, from eBay or through Knox Vintage Records. He occasionally will auction transcriptions. Early on, I bought some Lone Ranger transcriptions from Knox. Mm-hmm. Not this. Couldn't play them for a long time. A friend of mine had some, who was in the Navy in the 50s, had some AFRS transcriptions that he liberated of Bob and Ray shows, and they've been sitting on a shelf all these years.
Wow.
And so I had gathered a few things, and I started collecting programs from First Generation Radio Archives, John Brown.
Yeah.
And they used to offer a service where if you had shows they were interested in, originals, you could send them to them. Mm-hmm. They would make copies for their use, and then send you back a CD dub.
Sure.
So that's how the first time I heard transcriptions from my collection was that way, sending things off to Tom Brown.
So when did you get your first transcription player?
Later than it should have been. I want to say it was about 2007. Somebody on one of the listservs, maybe, offered a turntable, an esoteric turntable, up for sale that would handle 16-inch discs, and it barely handles 16-inch discs. I mean, the edge of the disc almost goes to where to where the tone arm pivots, and that was the first time I've been able to play them myself. And I think by that point I had been collecting discs from another email auction run by Mark Friend, who has all kinds of amazing
Broadway
records. Yeah,
yeah.
I had gotten some Jack Benny transcriptions, originals from the 40s, and I want to say that an episode of Jack Benny was the first transcription I ever played, first 16-inch transcription I ever played myself. Of course, I could handle anything smaller than that. Sometimes you'll run across programs on 12-inch or 14-inch.
When did you realize it's not as easy as it looks?
I mean, to play the discs?
Oh, yeah. Because a lot of people think that, okay, it's a big record.
Yeah.
You just put it on the turntable and you let it play.
Well, you can do that.
Yes.
But there's so much more to be gotten from the grooves if you kind of know what you're doing. That just came from reading what old-timers and experienced people were writing about. I joined the 78 record listserv. Roughly 2006 or 7. Also, the Association for Recorded Sound Collections Digest listserv. And I just started reading what people were saying. People were dealing with transcription discs even then. And a lot of the same techniques are used for regular records to coax, to coax the sound out.
Right. Well, the big difference, of course, being that consumer records had many, many hundreds, if not thousands, of copies.
That's right.
But you're often playing the only copy that exists.
You are. Or
so you've got to be a lot more careful.
That's very true. And especially if you're playing soft-cut lacquers, they're made out of soft material, so they can scratch and be damaged. And they have their own decomposition problems you have to worry about. But I first kind of learned about, you know, all these advanced tricks of the trade just from reading what people had to say, corresponding with people like David Lennick and Seth Winter and Mike Beal, and on the tape side, Tom Fine, whose parents were all into Mercury Records and things in the 50s and 60s. All these people were generous with their knowledge and tips on how to do things. And you learn a lot just by trial and error. I mean,
yeah, you do.
When you have a turntable and you have records, you...
I learned not to do them because it takes so much patience to get this done right. And
well, we're really lucky in this day and age. I mean, I've heard said, what is the right stylus for any particular record? And the answer sometimes is the one that will play it all the way through without skipping.
Yes, exactly.
Well, luckily, we don't have to really worry about that so much anymore because of how easy it is to do digital editing. I mean, in some of these Superman or Lone Ranger programs, if I'm listening while I'm dubbing, and if the thing skips or repeats or whatever, it's no big deal. I just walk over and place my hand and put the stylus back in the appropriate place. If I discover there's a dimple or something that's causing it to skip, I can apply pressure with my hand to keep the stylus from flying out and eventually get through that area and let it continue on. Then I just make a note of where that happened, Yep. Take it into digital editing and
you don't tape pennies to the
some occasionally. So all kinds.
I don't know
tricks.
If we want people to know that because that's supposedly.
But you don't have to get it right. You don't have to get it right on the initial playthrough.
When I was recording this, they were on reel tape, and I don't know how to edit reel tape.
Yeah.
You know, so I was dealing with the one that plays it all the way through. Kind of thing, but here you can take sections and reassemble them
easily,
beautifully.
Yeah, you never be able to tell. I mean, if it's edited well, you never be able to tell anything's missing.
Yeah. So, what are your interests, basically? I mean, you, Randy Riddle goes for a lot of very obscure stuff. You have your own obscure stuff that you like to go after. Some of it's news related.
Yeah, I am really interested in historical broadcasts, and over the past several years I've started collecting a lot of World War II era news broadcasts. Luckily, through various places, auctions and eBay, I found small collections that stations made of news broadcasts. In at least two cases, I've got a set of recordings made from an East Coast NBC affiliate and a set of recordings made from a West Coast CBS affiliate, KFPY in Spokane, Washington. They both apparently were just recording all this news that the networks were sending down the lines, and I've been lucky enough to find these discs, Churchill speeches and FDR speeches and some Edward R. Murrow things in there. It's really fascinating to me because it's history as it's being made.
Right.
You know?
Right, with all warts and all. Mm-hmm. And the live news is just fascinating.
Yeah.
Because you're learning about things almost as they're learning about them. So it is knowing what we know now about certain periods and then hearing the original broadcast, you can see how the story changes and how different pieces of news start to fit in. They piece pictures together.
We often say news is the first draft of history, and that's true. You will get things wrong. It's inevitable. There will always be things wrong. The purpose is to get it as right as possible, but also make it available to the people who need to know it.
Right.
And then as time kind of goes on and marches on, more facts come in. And
you keep refining it, improving it.
Aside from historical broadcasts, I'm really interested in entertainment programs from the 30s and 20s, things like Amos and Andy and Cecil and Sally, especially if they were early syndicated shows, because that's really interesting, and that's an area where a lot of OTR collectors, because the programs are so different and sometimes hard to access, a lot of mainstream OTR collectors, and I mean people who just want to hear Jack Benny and Suspense, they're not particularly interested in Louie's Hungry Five, which is a show that Randy has been putting out, or Cecil and Sally, or even the early Amos and Andys, which are very different than the later sitcom version we're familiar with. And I'm also interested in early network entertainment programs, and have come across, through the late Rich Connedy, a large collection of Lucky Strike Hours that were live NBC program done in 32 and 33, and probably the advertising agency or the sponsor was making recordings onto Victor Home recording disc, which is a consumer format, but has surprising fidelity and can record a lot of material on a side. So it made it a interesting or obvious choice rather to as a way to preserve broadcasts. And I don't know of another, just outside of perhaps maybe Rudy Valley's recordings, I don't know of another network entertainment show that has so many extant recordings. Now, unfortunately, Rich died about 6 months ago, and his collection is kind of in limbo right now. But it's my hope that those recordings will be somehow saved and preserved and made available for researchers and fans.
Yeah. Now, some of your recordings are available. Well, you have them up on SoundCloud.
Right. I have a SoundCloud channel, which I think is soundcloud.com/Sammy-Jones or something. You can Google it or find it pretty easily. Yeah, so I put some highlights of things up there. I put one of the Lucky Strike Hours that I did from Rich's collection online there. And I should go ahead and, if you're looking for great sound, I should apologize for that one. I didn't try to do really much speed correction. But those Victor home recording discs are really tough because they change speeds in the within the same side.
Right.
It's not a professional recording device. So there's some pitch problems and that stuff. But the whole thing is there. I mean, you can pretty much listen to it and get an idea of what it sounds like. I've also put some of the news broadcasts up there, Churchill speeches and FDR. I think I put the crepitation contest.
No, you don't put stuff like that on the internet. People don't do that.
That came from David. That came from David Linick.
Who had
a set of discs from the CBC or something.
Yes.
Put that up there quite a while ago.
Yes.
So there's kind of a smorgasbord of things on that channel. No real theme as to what I do. Yeah. Just whatever seems interesting.
So what does your studio look like today? What's your favorite software? What are some of the equipment?
Well, my studio is in a bit of disarray. I just moved into a new house.
Yeah.
And I do have the turntable set up where I can listen and do some dubbing, but it's not how it's going to be.
Okay.
It's not how I've
So what's your plan?
Well, it's really just a matter of moving furniture in and getting things placed, but I'll talk a little bit about the equipment. My favorite turntable, and the turntable is favored by a lot of transfer engineers and old-time collectors, is the Technics SP-15. Mm-hmm. So I'm lucky enough to have one of those, and that
sounds new.
It's not. It's made about 1980 or so. Newer,
okay.
But it's still.
Are those born before?
Almost 40 years old.
Yeah. Yes. I wish I was 40 years old again. So. it's a newer vintage than one that was used in the 40s.
Right. Not a vintage.
Yeah.
40s
so
machine,
so it's so. Surprising that they were still making something like that at that time.
It's kind of interesting that they were. Yeah. Somebody who was really into hi-fi in the 80s might know why they did that and what it was marketed to. But it plays transcriptions beautifully, even 17-inch transcriptions. You can adjust the arm height. And of course, the turntable itself, any turntable will play a 16-inch disc. It's a matter of where the arm is mounted and how long the arm is.
Right. And
but these
but don't SP, you have a problem where if the arm is short, it starts playing the groove at the wrong angle?
That's right. You always have, with any disc recording, you have that problem to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
Because the discs were recorded linearly with a cutter on a feed screw that moved across the disc just like that.
Right.
And any arm is going to track
at an angle.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so you try to, it's all kind of a compromise. Any disc playback like that. But yeah, for a larger disc, you need a longer arm to minimize the tracking error.
Mm-hmm.
And all this can happen with the SP-15, which also has direct drive and port speed control and just all kinds of great features that you need. It also is prone to chip failure after a while, which is a big pain. But there is a guy, Dave Cawley, I think is his name, in England, who is now making replacement chips to drive the computer parts to these turntables.
It almost sounds like what some of the people who restore cars go through to find certain parts.
For a long time, nobody was making a replacement chip for these turntables, and he started doing it, which is great news for people who love that turntable.
It is.
I tend to use a Shure SS78E stylus. Mm-hmm. It's kind of my go-to stylus. It's a 2.5 mil truncated elliptical stylus. It's not in production anymore. It hasn't been for a long time. So I tend to buy them up whenever I see them on eBay. I think I have probably a store of about 6 or 8 of the things.
Okay.
Really good place to start. That doesn't mean it's the magic stylus that'll work for everything, but it tends to make really good sound and track really well for most discs. I also have a smaller selection of Stanton styli. I've got a 1.75, which is not really what I wanted. I wanted a 2, but I couldn't get it anymore. I've got a 2.5 Stanton, which is the same size as the Shure. I've got a 3.25. But basically, all records, the groove size, even when it's quote unquote standardized, could vary a little bit.
Right.
And as records are played and worn, different areas of the groove get worn. So it's helpful to have a selection so you can move up and down the groove wall to try to find the sweet spot.
We don't think of that because the grooves don't look very deep when you're looking at it. But from this, these are microscopic differences that you're talking about.
We talk about a 2.5 mil. Mil is a thousandth of an inch.
Yeah.
And an LP stylus is 0.7 mils. Mm-hmm. So not even 1/1000th of an inch. So we're talking about really small, really small points and groove widths.
Yeah.
So I've also got a 5.0 mil, which is essential for playing those Victor Home recording discs. They're a really wide and shallow groove. So that's just the turntable and the stylus.
Yeah. What about software?
Software, I'm using something called Goldwave, which is just a standard audio editor. Nothing special, but it does the job. Sounds fine. Really easy to make cuts and do fades and adjust levels. You can do some equalization in there.
Do you use Audacity at all? A lot of collectors like Audacity because it's free.
I haven't really used Audacity. And I don't like to use sound noise reduction and suppression tools on a lot of those things.
Yeah.
Because I just don't like the artifacts they leave. Yeah. And that's not to say that some people who know how to tweak the controls just right can't get good results, but I really prefer...
There are a lot of aspects of radio recordings that many noise reduction programs think are noise when they're actually sound effects.
Yeah, sure.
So it's gunshots, you've got to be very, very careful.
There's all kinds of sounds that are supposed to be there that shouldn't be taken out. And also the artifacts that get left behind is most objectionable to me. I would much rather hear clicks and pops and a little bit of hiss than underwater jingly sleigh bells and things, you know.
And this is one of the reasons I work with people who do transcription recordings, and they always have two copies of their recordings. They have a raw recording that's unprocessed, and then they'll have a processed recording. And the reason they keep the raw recording is in case they make a mistake in processing.
That's right.
But also, some new software or new technique may come along that can work on the original recording that we obviously can't know about now because it may not be invented or available.
I even keep the unedited original transfer file.
All right, so that disc that had the skip in it and all that, you have that raw, the really raw file.
Yes.
And you just make notes on it?
In case I ever need to. I keep a spreadsheet on... Well, I mean, I keep a spreadsheet on every disc I do with... Mm-hmm. The matrix number information and all the pertinent information, what equalization I use, what stylus selection I use. And probably if it's just a matter of fixing some skips here and there, I don't know that I would keep that necessarily on the spreadsheet. But as soon as I'm done, I would go through and listen to it again and snip all those things out. But keep the original just in case I find that I made a mistake.
Sure.
Oh, gosh, you're missing three words. I'll have to go back to the original. Just in case there's no reason, because storage is so cheap these days, there's really no reason not to not to keep all the versions that might come
out. So are you a wave man or are you a flack man or yes?
Yes, I tend to usually work in wave. I know a lot of high-end collectors prefer flack because it cuts the storage space in half.
Right.
And that's fine. Flack is lossless, so there's no reason if you want to store files in flack, go for it. I'm not to the point where I have that many hours of recordings on my hard drives
to
start really making tough choices on that. Definitely do not keep your archival copies as MP3.
No. So if you get a disc recording, I mean, it's fine to make an MP3 copy that you're going to listen to or put on your MP3 player. That's why it's called an MP3 player, in case you were wondering. But you should have somewhere that original copy, because...
Ideally, it should be in multiple somewheres.
Yeah.
Even in the case when, if you as a collector keep a copy on one hard drive and a second hard drive, well, collectors die.
Yeah.
And collectors' families don't always really care that much about their collection.
This is one reason why I've liked this hobby, is that we tend to collect in groups. Mm-hmm. You know, groups of friends share the same things, share the same collection, and that's one reason why so many programs have stayed in circulation.
I would suggest that if you were dealing with original first-generation material, that you find a collecting friend, somebody who's interested as well, and the two of you share files. And at least in that way, you have a duplicate.
Exactly.
That can be handled by somebody else.
Exactly.
In the case of your untimely demise.
Yes. Yes. So, we've been talking for a while, so I want to get to a question that relates to what you do now, which is in broadcast production, television broadcast production. How has your knowledge of the history of the medium and recording affected your job and the nature of your job and
what you
do with other engineers?
I don't really work too much in engineering. I write and produce segments.
Okay.
In a past iteration of my career, I did quite a bit of editing, which all goes back to the things I learned as I began to collect radio programs.
So your interest in the technology is not your position right now, but it's still in your back pocket.
Sure.
So you can boss the production people around.
Just kidding. More and more lines get blurred. I mean, we have production assistants who do editing for us, but even more and more now, producers are doing their own editing. So even in my current job, where mainly I'm a writer-producer, I still will edit things as necessary. So you have to have some knowledge of technical things, and it helps at least I believe to understand as much as you can about everybody's job, because it all kind of comes together. Like, you understand why you do things.
And if you're in the news business, you never know when the deadline's going to move and it's going to get closer to you unexpectedly.
That's true.
So all hands on deck.
Right.
Yeah. So what are your what are some of the things you're working on right now? Do you have anything in particular that people would find of interest beyond these interesting Supermans?
The Supermans have not been released to the public yet.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to figure out what the best way is to do that, because these literally are one of a kind and have not been heard. So I'm trying to find a way that makes sense to get them out. They've all been transferred and are ready and are preserved and safe. So hopefully at some point there'll be an announcement about what's going to happen with those. I've got a lot of things that have been just sitting there for a while that I need to get to. I just moved recently kind of transferred everything.
You have totally wrong priorities, obviously.
But it makes it easier now because I've just gotten things.
Space.
I've just gotten things back up on shelves, and I'm kind of putting things together. So I would love to make my next big project be those Lucky Strike Hours from 32 and 33, because those are really rare and interesting, and so those are certainly the only copies of those broadcasts. Just got to figure out how to make that happen. That may be a little difficult, but I'm hopeful.
Okay, well, that's good. Thank you very much.
All right.
By the way, we were outside at a Panera in Atlanta. Is this technically Atlanta?
No, this is I don't even know if it's Decatur. We're close enough to Atlanta to have Atlanta.
We're right near Emory University.